originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Bradley come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Baraj aboard crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studio. I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, and also to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. So a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to former riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries, and I'm excited to tell you all about a very, very wonderful event coming up here in Versailles, Kentucky. It's called Ragin' Cajun at the Castle. It's a PDJF fundraising event that will be held on April 23rd from 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. Doors open at 6. Tickets are $75 a person. There will be a buffet. There's going to be an auction. And the auction, I tell you, there are some really special items up for bid here, including a halter worn by Arrogate, a week in the Caribbean. I mean, there's some really, really great items going up for auction here, so don't miss it. You can purchase tickets at the website www.pdjf.org. Now, without further ado, my guest this evening is a former rider with over 600 victories under his belt. He traded in the riding boots for a condition book, and now he's an agent to the stars, having represented riders such as Shane Sellers, Joel Rosario, Joe Talamo, and just announced that he will now have Robbie Alvarado's book. He's affectionately known as the Love Man. It's a pleasure to introduce to you all jockey agent Ronnie Ebanks. Ronnie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here. Are you able to hear me good enough?
I can hear you loud and clear, Ronnie. And
beautiful.
You just told me you've just arrived in Kentucky. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, this was just a last-minute big surprise to me. I was on my way to Florida for the Florida Derby to spend a week there for a little business and a little pleasure, and I got a call. I reached out and speak to a friend of mine, the agent, Lenny Pike, who was representing Ralph Alvarado, and out of the blue, he informed me that, I was trying to offer him a bug ride I wanted to send to him, and he informed me that he had resigned the night before, and that Robbie needed an agent, and would I like to work for him? I'm like, whoa. But it was just caught me as a surprise. So I landed in Lexington Sunday evening.
Not quite a surprise, like you just said. And I assume you guys are gearing up for Keeneland.
Yeah, we're in full swing. We had entries yesterday for opening day. I think we're on 5 horses. Today we entered for Saturday. We ride all the stakes. I think we have 6 or 7 mounts and some really good quality stake horses, the Bluegrass and the Ashland and Shakertown. So it's going to be a big weekend, exciting one for me and Robbie.
Good stuff, Ronnie. Good stuff. And you're representing jockeys now, and you know what it's like because you used to be one yourself. And I can't wait to hear that side of your story because I'm familiar with your agent career, but I am totally in the dark when it comes to your riding career. And I would love to hear about how you got started in the game, Ronnie.
Great. Well, it's really amazing journey, and it started from 12 and a half years old, not quite 13, and it was another out of, you know, a super surprise. I knew nothing about horses, had no really desire or like horses, and I was influenced by the love of my oldest brother, who I idolized, because he loved horses. I decided I was going to love horses, and I ventured down a few houses from where I was living and met a kid in the front yard. His dad had a few horses in the back, a little training track, a little barn, and I, after meeting him, he said he had to help his dad. I said, I'd go help you, and I went and helped started cleaning the stalls, and he said, we do this every day about this time, so I came around the next day to hang out. He said, I'm going to the barn. I went with him and just, you know, digging in, helping clean the stalls, and the father offered me a job. He said, if I wanted to come every day and do that, he'd pay me $40 a week, and I couldn't wait to start. So that was how it really all began.
And where was this? Where did you grow up?
This was in Louisiana, a little town called Erath, Louisiana, which some really good riders, Randy Romero, was, you know, raised 4 miles up the road from me. He was, you know, practically a Hall of Fame rider. He is a Hall of Fame rider and a great, great career, a good friend of mine. Shane Sellers, who I represented for 13 years, is from Erath. There's Kent DeZormo, raced for Bale, some really big riders could come out of that same little area in Louisiana. So, and we had to put out a match race track, Cajun Downs. I started ride racing when I was 13, 6 months after grooming horses. The guy asked if I wanted to be a jockey, and I said I would love to. So he actually sent me down to Randy Romero's father's farm, and his brother taught me how to ride a horse. Put me on a racehorse with a pony alongside of me, and I did that for about 3 months till I learned how to ride a horse, which I had never been on one before. And then I went back for the work for the guy, Lynn Gutierrez, that I was cleaning stalls for, and started galloping his horses as he began to teach me about riding and, you know, eventually to start racing.
So you were 13 when you rode your first race?
13 years old, and rode my first, is a quarter horse, going 250 yards. It was a six-horse field. We only had six gates there in the match. It was a half a mile straightaway, match racetrack in Louisiana. And they were running, I think, for $100 a man, six horses. And I rode a horse by the name of Sneaky Pete. I carried about 30 pounds of lead so I could make the 120 pounds. And he won by a nose. So the first race I ever rode,
wow.
I ended up winning by a nose.
That had to be such an awesome feeling for a 13-year-old kid, especially, and that's your first race ever, and you just had to be on cloud nine. My God.
You don't even know. You don't even know. It was like landing on the moon for me. I couldn't believe it. It was just surreal. First race, first win. The crowd was, it was a huge, a big race. They didn't have many six-horse races. Usually it was two-horse races, the quarter horses.
Oh.
And this was, we put a six-horse race together, so the fans loved it. And, for me to win that, it was just, I'll never forget that feeling, I'll never forget that day.
Wow.
And that was the start of a really unbelievable success and run, because right away, it didn't take me long. I become very popular quick. I really was just natural, somehow athletic and for horses, and having never been around them. Because within 3 to 4, 5 months, I was riding almost every race run and always in riding, you know, usually the best horses, the owners were coming looking for me. So I did that for about 2 years, a little over 2 years, waiting to be old enough to be able to become an official jockey. And I probably won, you know, maybe, I don't know, 200 races or more while I was in the bushes in these match races. And I remember at 13 and a half, or 14 years old, I came home one day and I had $2,800 stuffed in every one of my pockets. Me and my mom started counting it. I couldn't believe it. And I'd won all three of the big races that day, plus two others. And as a 14-year-old kid in the bushes, I made, you know, almost $3,000 in one day. My father didn't make that in a month.
Wow. So they had to be pretty proud of you, no doubt. And what, were you going to high school at this time?
I was in high school. I was actually, let's see, I quit at 15. I was in eighth grade at 13 when I first started riding. And when I quit school in the 10th grade, to go professional.
Right.
I was honestly only 15 years old, supposed to be 16. I had a new birth certificate made so I could run my I don't know if I can say it.
Oops.
Say that.
we are on radio, yeah, right?
I started riding a year early, and I left home at 15, quit the 10th grade. Well, I didn't quit. I moved like 2 hours away, about 180 miles to Benton, Louisiana, where Delta Downs was. And I went to school in the day, and I raced at night.
Okay.
So that was an unbelievable journey. And it's there when I first got to start riding professionally at Evangeline Downs. At 15, my mom would pick me up at 4 o'clock in the morning, drive me 30 miles to Evangeline Downs so I could gallop horses and get to meet the trainers. And she did that for about 4 or 5 weeks until I was ready. And then I started riding. And that Evangeline only went for about 1 month. And then we moved to Delta Downs. So I told my mom, I've got to go now. I was a real tall and lean kid. I said, if I don't get to leave home now and go start my career, I might not make it by the time next year. I might be too big.
Right.
So she talked my dad into letting me quit school there, moving away a couple hours away to Vinton, and as long as I would get my diploma, in which I did. And then my first season riding at Delta Downs, I was leading rider as an apprentice. I was going to school in the day 5 days a week and riding 3 nights a week, and then Saturday and Sunday during the day.
Oh, my God.
And I was the first apprentice that had ever been a lead rider, actually.
Really? That's quite the accomplishment.
Cool.
And, my God, when did you sleep?
I got home from riding about midnight, 12 to 12:30. I would be in bed, and I got up at 5 to go race, to go to the track to gallop. And I'd go to the track till about 7:30, run home and shower, and go to school. Mm-hmm. And I get out of school. I had time to go home for, about an hour and a half nap. And then by 6 o'clock, I had to be at the jocks room, and the race had started, I think, 7.
That's a pretty...
So I just did that. I did that, raced 5 days a week. And, so I had Monday and Tuesday afternoons and evenings I got to sleep and rest.
Thank God.
That's as a kid that age, and here I am winning 2, 3, 4 races a day. I'm making, back then I was making $2,000 a week. It was just surreal.
It was
worth
it. I was
a rock star. I had a brand new car. I was the, most popular kid in school for sure. I lived the dream life. I still do.
Oh my God. It just, wow. That had to be incredible. And your parents, your parents sounded so supportive. Your mom driving you there, and they were obviously, all about it.
Well, I'll tell you, my mom at 14 or 13, I've tried to talk me out of it because I was a real pretty smart student. And of all, she had 5 boys. And of all of them, it was me. She thought I'd go to college. And she's like, I didn't hang out with anybody at school. I didn't play any other sports. I was just at that barn every day. And she said to me that I was too much. I didn't have no friends. I needed to socialize. And I had to stop spending so much. And I told her that this is what I want to do the rest of my life. You can make me do what you want, but this is the love of my life. This is what I'm going to be no matter what happens. So she said, are you sure? And she was so convinced of my passion and my commitment, then she turned and got 100% behind me. And, my dad was very strict and kind of the dominant one in their family. When it comes time for me to want to leave home, he said no. And I went crying to her and told her, this is my chance. If I don't go now, it's like make or break. I might never get the chance. And she stood up to him and talked him in and let me leave. So she's been my biggest support, my biggest fan. And, of course, my brothers all used to come and support me and thought it was so cool, too, because they'd come and get to see me race, at 13, 14, 15.
Joggy agent Ronnie Ebanks is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Ronnie, with that support group behind you, you got them to root for you, and then your leading rider, leading apprentice at Delta Downs. Where did your career take you from there?
So that meet ended after me being leading rider. We moved over to Evangeline Downs, which is the next meet. I started off leading rider there, and I make up my mind I don't want to be a small town jock. I want to go for the big time. So I had only had about a month and a half left of my apprenticeship, so I said I better go now while I got that to get me started somewhere. So I left there and went to the main track at Louisiana Downs, which was like the bigger track. You know, mm-hmm. it was a major for Louisiana speaking. So I went there following my idol, Randy Romero. He got me his agent to take my book. It was a very famous agent, Mr. Bud Amey, whose son was Fred Amey, that was Pat Day's agent for 15 years. So Bud was a legend, and he said he would take me. So I went and left while I still had to go to Louisiana Downs. And in hindsight, it was a big mistake. Well, it wasn't a mistake, I take it back. But I struggled because no one knew me. By the time they got to know me, I lost the bug. So now I'm riding with these guys been riding for, you know, a long time and much more experience. But so I struggled for about a year, year and a half right after that. And then I left there in a year later and went to Phoenix, Arizona on the recommendation of a trainer, Frankie Brothers, who's the number one trainer that I was getting on horses for. And the owner of the track in Arizona was looking for a rider, and they called him. He recommended me, said, take this kid. He's talented. Nobody knows him, but he's very good. So they did. They gambled on me. So I went out to Phoenix, Arizona, and they had an agent set up for me. I was riding for the owner of the track, for the leading trainer. And the storybook started again. I won like four the opening day. I won 13 races the first week at Turf Paradise, and it was on again. It was just unbelievable. So I ended up leading. I was leading rider by 30 wins in front of the second guy. And come the springtime, I left and went to Chicago and followed the leading trainer there who was in Chicago. So I went there with him, and that's how I ended up in the Chicago Sportsman's Park, Hawthorne, Arlington. I rode around there a couple years, and then I left and went up Detroit. So my career kind of took me a little bit of everywhere, you know?
It's a life of a rider, right?
Yeah, mainly Chicago. I ended up at Detroit. I went to Hazel Park. I was leading rider in Detroit. And mind you, I'm 5'8", 5'9", you know, toward the end of my career, trying to be 110 pounds. So it was like, for me making it 7 years was a miracle. Everyone thought I'd make it a year or two because of my size. So after Detroit, I ended up down in New Orleans at the fairgrounds. I got married at 19. 3 months later, my wife's pregnant. You know, I'm having a baby. It was like, oh, my gosh.
Oh my goodness.
So we settle in Chicago. My daughter's born. I'm racing there. And I ride up till 87 with, you know, much success. I took over to Jock's Room Kitchen. I was riding and running the kitchen in the Chicago tracks because I love kind of entrepreneurship and I love restaurant business. So I also did that. And then I retired at... In 87, I went to my father-in-law. I went to Kentucky Derby Day and rode a horse in a stake for him in the WHAS. He had Gary Stevens' name on him. He didn't know him. He had got on him by accident. And he called me and brought me into Kentucky, took Stevens off, put me on. The horse wins.
Wow.
Wins by a nose, Derby Boo, 1987. And it was like the second. I think the first day I won was big. This would end up somehow bigger, winning on Derby Day in front of 140,000 people.
I can't imagine the crowd and the noise and the rush that had to bring. And how long did that occur before you retired?
So that was in May, and I rode until November at Hawthorne. And decided just battling my weight. It had just gotten so tough, and I didn't like the winters. So I took the winter off, thought I'd ride in the spring, but I met this young kid, Shane Sellers, that came in, and I looked at him and saw how talented he was, and he was riding the little track in Illinois, and I talked him into coming the next year. I told him I'd quit riding and take his book. Mm-hmm. And so I quit riding for the winter. In the spring, February of 88, I took Shane Sellers' book and became his agent. And we had a record 13-year career. You know, we rode the Derby that year. The next year, the first year I had him, horse didn't run anywhere good. But from then on, we rode the Derby every year. He'd become leading rider at Arlington Park. We broke the record, shattered the single-season record. Coincidentally, my friend Randy Romero had the record of 168 wins. Hmm. We broke it. We went out 228 winners. So we had an amazing run in Chicago, me and him, for a couple of years. And then we left and went into Kentucky, Keeneland, Churchill. From there, we went to Gulfstream. The second year in Kentucky, we dethroned Pat Day for the first time in 12 years that it had been done at Keeneland. And went down to Florida. We beat Jerry Bailey out for leading rider. We were just on a storybook for the next, you know, 4, 5, 6 years.
Wow, that's incredible.
So and I ended up representing Ronnie, 18 years, I think, Sellers.
Listening to you describe, you know, your riding career and then your agent career and listening to this, it perfectly depicts the ups and downs in the sport. You mentioned going to Louisiana Downs and struggling there, and then going to Arizona, you were leading rider, and then, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So many ups and downs in this game. How do you deal with that?
Well, you know, that's the thing. Early on, you learn that if you're doing great, you're going to be losing 80% of the time. That's the number one thing. When you realize that, you adjust your thinking about the result. You know, it's not sometimes not the the result, it's the journey, you know. So I just always realized that when one race was over, there was nothing you could do about it. You have to turn the page to get to the next chapter, you know, and I could be the feature story in the next chapter. So I always built a positive attitude and self-motivation, you know, through the time. You learn that if you didn't have a thick skull, the game wasn't going to be for you because it eats you up and spits you out. It's a really tough game.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And you mentioned another low, being a tall rider and dealing with your weight. And I know well about the struggles of keeping your weight down. And my God, I remember, Ronnie, when I first saw you and I was like, wow, he rode? Oh, my God. I mean, you're tall. That had to be so difficult. And what was it like whenever you first retired and you were able to eat again?
Well, forget about it. First of all, when I was, you know, when I was racing and I first started at 15, I was a little bigger than the rest of them. And my friend told me, if you don't learn to get rid of that food, you're not going to be light enough. Yeah. You're 110, they're all 16 and 17. If you don't get down to 106, 107, they're going to get all the mounts. So he taught me how to, we call it heave, get rid of my food. So for the next 7 years of my whole career, I didn't get to keep my food down. Whatever I ate, I had to get rid of.
Right.
So I had a choice to become bulimic or not be, you know, riding very long. And I was growing. So I more or less stunted my growth. So I went to bed hungry and woke up hungry probably 98% of my life, the first seven years. So it was tough. And the longer toward the end, it was got tougher because I kept growing. You know, I started out, I was 5'4". When I ended my career, I was 5'9½", trying to stay 110 pounds. So it was brutally tough on me, physically, mentally, both. So when I was able to quit, finally, it was a blessing that I could keep fluid in me, water, you know, nourishment. And I gained 38 pounds in 3 weeks. Wow. And probably 30 pounds of it was fluid.
Right.
I'd been really living dehydrated. So I felt like a new person, honestly. I remember, after about a month and a half, thinking, I feel so much smarter, so much more aware, more common sense. It's like I took the helmet off and got brains. But it was the dehydration and struggling physically, my body, that had me, you know, my nervous system, I think my mental, everything was not balanced, but I didn't even know. I didn't find out till, you know, I got it back.
You are exactly right. What that does to your body, and I struggled too and did some of the things you mentioned, and it's not good, but like you said, when you're faced with that or just not to ride, well, we love what we do, so we make those choices. But it is amazing how greatly that affects your mental function, just your ability to think on your feet, which is, of course, extremely important when you're on the back of a horse. You have to make split-second decisions. So it is tough. It's tough to balance all of that. And now I'm going to ask you, get to this question. Do you think the riding weights are too low?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Just because the generations of humans, the body, that were getting bigger and bigger and bigger, it's proven, it's shown. So that's the problem, because 50 years ago, you know, people seemed to be a lot smaller, a lot lighter, smaller boned, you know, we're growing and growing and growing, I think. It shows nationally. So that being said, the only small people you see, that, you know, more South Americans are naturally small. That's why we have so many more South American riders, because they're also naturally lightweight, you know, so much more opportunity. So the weights, it's definitely, you know, the horses in Europe carrying 30, 32, you know, they carry 150 pounds every morning, 7 days a week. It's just crazy that they don't understand that, you know, carrying 115 or 120 ain't going to be that much difference. I definitely think it shouldn't be much lighter than 118, 120 that any horse carries, unless it's an apprentice kid, you know?
Right. Well, and obviously, you know, Shane Sellers went to bat for the jocks, and you had his book, so you know all of, you know, the struggles riders have dealt with over the year, you being one yourself. You mentioned, you know, South American riders being naturally lighter, and that is definitely true. What I also want to point out is that you Cajun boys, you Louisiana guys, man, some talented riders. My God, thinking about the names you mentioned in the area you grew up, Shane Sellers, Randy Romero, yourself. Is it something in the water? I'm just trying to figure this out.
Well, what it was back then was we had, you know, five or six tracks all around there that were racing on Saturday and Sundays. So we all started, they started riding. Delahousie told me he started at 9, him and Randy Romero. I started at 13 or 20, no, 12, really, 12 and a half, 13. They started at 9. So it was like a culture for any kid that was small enough. Everybody down the road from you had racehorses, so all the small kids gravitated there. They had, you know, I remember being 10, 12 little jockeys on a Sunday at that track competing for mounts in the two-horse races, three-horse races. So there were jocks everywhere. Now they don't even have no tracks anymore. And secondly, before they closed them all, there were like half the amount of riders before around there. So at that time, it was just such a big part of that Louisiana culture. And any little guy got pushed or told about being a jockey and, you know, ventured to it, really. So we had a lot more riders getting the opportunity and taking the opportunity.
You mentioned just that being part of the culture and how common it was and popular it was because of those bush tracks. And it's sad to see those tracks have gone away. Is it still part of the culture now, or is it all different and people have their iPhones and everything else? Is it different?
No, the bad part is all that southern part of Louisiana, they, because of insurance and lawsuits and liability, they closed all of them tracks. I don't know of any myself that's open anymore. And I know there was five of them I used to ride at that I don't think none of them are racing now. So where do they go? Where do they learn? They just learn on a farm, you know, without racing. I rode, you know, I don't know how many races, you know, before I'd ever started riding professionally. I was 2 years ahead of these guys. That's why I was so good so early. I was already polished, you know, winning 6-8 races a weekend. So now they don't have that. And they just got a jockey school a few years ago, which is the new possibility. But before that, it was never one. In all the other countries, South America, you know, they have a jockey school. So that's how they got such prepared compared to Americans.
Ronnie, we got to take a quick commercial break. Folks, stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. Congratulations to Sean Bridgemahan for his 3,000th career win on Saturday. Bridgemahan had a solid week as he finished in the money on 56% of his mounts with 6 wins, 6 seconds, and 2 third-place finishes. Florent Giroux won his second straight Fairgrounds riding title by an impressive 37 wins. Giroux finished the week with 5 wins, 4 seconds, and 5 third-place finishes. Jose Ortiz had a great week as he won 3 stakes races, highlighted by a win in the Grade 2 Honey Fox aboard Celestine. Ortiz finished the week with 5 wins, 6 seconds, and 4 third-place finishes. Finally, the Jockeys Guild Jockey of the Week, Brian Hernandez Jr., punched his ticket to the Derby as he guided home Gervin in the Louisiana Derby. Hernandez led North America in earnings and finished the week with 4 wins, 3 seconds, and 1 third-place finish. John Parada's newest book, Half a Chance, is available now at JockeyTalk360.com. Half a Chance is the story of a down-on-his-luck jockey agent who finds himself entangled in a web of deceit and larceny and provides the kind of entertaining read that is ideal for any racing fan. Visit JockeyTalk360.com for more information. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. For all the latest news in the jockey world, visit JockeyTalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at Jockey Talk.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigle, and I am joined tonight by jockey agent Ronnie Ebanks. And Ronnie, I would like to remind the listeners tonight about a really wonderful event coming up on April 23rd. It's a PDJF event, Ragin' Cajun at the Castle. And tell our listeners a little bit more about that.
Okay, so what we're having is a benefit party. It's going to be a karaoke with a DJ dance party. We're having Tommy Walter's Cajun food catered. It's going to be at the Castle in Lexington on that Sunday night, the 23rd, right after the race is about 6:30. And we're throwing it to benefit the Permanently Disabled Jockeys and the Simone Project, which is a village in South Africa that we've been supporting for 10 to 12 years now, helping bringing food and clothing and medicine to them. And so we splitting the benefit on them two organizations. And we're just getting all the horsemen and friends together for a party, as me and Shane Sellers used to do for years, traveling the country, racing. Every once a week, we would have a karaoke somewhere with friends at some bar and fill the place up and have a great time. So it's always drawing all our friends and fans together. So we're going to do it and do it for a good cause and have a great time.
I can't wait to be there, Ronnie. Folks, if you'd like to participate, it's on Sunday, April 23rd from 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. at the Castle in Versailles. Doors open at 6. Tickets are $75 a person. You can purchase those at www.pdjf.org, and you're hearing Ronnie's wonderful story here tonight. You'll get to meet him at this wonderful event, so don't miss out at this wonderful event on April 23rd. Ronnie, you mentioned Shane Sellers again and how close you two were. You took his book right after you retired, and you guys worked together for many, many years, and you don't often see that. You see, you know, jocks and agents split up and then, you know, change hands, and you guys were together for so long. And what was that like when you first took his book, and you had just recently retired. Was it, did you miss riding while you were running his business, or was it kind of a relief not to worry about your weight, or what was that thought process?
Honestly, I was so glad because I was so tired and hungry, and, you know, all the time, and it was getting to the end of me being able to do that and maintain the weight to ride. So it was such a big relief. And what happened, what I found was, being Shane's agent, when we started doing well and winning and things really got rolling, it felt as if I was part of it. Mm-hmm. So the adrenaline, the excitement was still there. So that made me not miss riding. And I really didn't miss riding for the longest time. You know, I'd say it was 4, 5, 6, 8 years before I kind of missed it, you know, really missed it. And then it didn't bother me too bad because I got over it because I was so successful as an agent. My jocks were winning, you know, on top of the game. So it was almost like I didn't leave the excitement, that same adrenaline. So it was just amazing.
It definitely makes sense. And would you say you two worked so well together because you knew each other for so long?
Well, we come from the same hometown. Yeah, you know, and our success was, it was just working. He was such a good rider. Mm-hmm. And things were just working so good for me as an agent. I had all the, you know, the connections with the people. You know, I had a gift gab, and he seen that. I knew that. And it was working. And I think me having been the jockey before was a big, big asset. And him learning and wanting to be better, he was open to me coaching him, you know, giving him the feedback, what he could improve, and motivating him. So it's just, it worked. We just become a strong team, you know. And, of course, we didn't go without our own troubles. He left me once. It went to New York for the winter, and it wasn't happy. He came back. I left him once, went to, you know, California with Chris Antley, and it didn't work out for the summer. Then I came back. So, but overall, I think we were together 13 years.
Wow. That's a long...
So it worked. At the end of the day, it worked out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You mentioned being a jockey was a big asset, changing careers to a jockey agent. You knew what was going on, and you had been out there on the back of those horses before. Would you say you were... I don't know how to say, like, extra cautious as far as putting him on safe horses just because you did that before?
I always tried to definitely protect him, and I treated him as if it was my son. You know, I cared for him. So it wasn't about the money for me. It was absolutely about getting him on the best horse and protecting him. So if I didn't, you know, if I didn't feel safe, I would definitely turn down that situation.
Absolutely. And, God, you guys are together for so long. You found so much success. What happened after Shane Sellers?
Say it again, man.
What happened after Shane Sellers? When you guys did he retire? And so that's
he got hurt. He got hurt. Yeah, he got hurt in the fairgrounds. The horse dropped him in the post, and the horse stepped on his knee, and he had to have a big operation. He was going to be out a year, and we separated there. I went on and went to New York. I took Jorge Chavez for about a year and a half. I first took Mark Guidry and took him to Saratoga. After Saratoga, he came back to Kentucky. I went back to New York, took Jorge Chavez. He had just won the Derby the year before, and him and his agent decided to part. So he called me. I went up there, took him. I worked with him about a year and a half, and then he got hurt in Florida, the Florida Derby. Horse broke down. He was going to be out about 6 or 8 months. I didn't want to go back into New York, and I decided to go off and play poker, become a professional poker player. So I went off and chased the poker tour for about a year and a half, and had some success, done well, and I just realized it was not the world for me because it was just, you know, too much night and days upside down and gambling every day, and it was unbalanced, my personal life. So I came back into racing. Patrick Valenzuela called me to come to California, so he was coming off a 2-year being rolled off. And I went out there, took him, and we took off and leading light in the nation in about 2 months of him being back. Oh. And I worked for him for a year and had an amazing run. But so after Patrick Valenzuela, I about 11 months, that relationship just got to be too much for me, and me and him had some different opinions. So I resigned from there and went back home again to take off some time. And then Joe Talamo come. They called me from a friend of mine, an ex-jockey, called me about this kid Talamo at the fairgrounds for me to take him. So I flew in, met him and his parents, and made a deal for me to take him to New York or California. And he had just been leading right at the fairgrounds. So I took him, went to New York with him, was going to stay there. And the first week I sent him out to California to ride for Bobby Sprinkle for the weekend, and he won 3 races, and I ended up sending him back to California, and he won the 2-3 races that day. So I called him and said to stay there. I'm going to pack our bags in New York. We're coming to California. Let's stay there instead. So I went to California, took Joe Talamo, and had an unbelievable run. I was second leading rider at Hollywood Park. He had the bug. He was second leading rider at Del Mar. And we just had a great, great run together. And then I took Tyler Bayes along with Joe, and he got to doing really well. They were 1-2 leading rider. And Joe's family's mother got really upset and I think jealous that Joe, I had 2 riders and the other rider was winning a bunch of races also. And she thought Joe should have been riding all them horses, I guess. And Joe comes to me one day, he said, my mom can't sleep at night. I said, I've got to choose. You got to either take me or Tyler. So I told him I wouldn't do that. So if you need to get an agent, get one. So he got another agent and I kept Tyler Bayes. And from there I had Tyler Bayes. I had Michael Bayes. Michael left, came into Kentucky, and unfortunately died. And then I got offered to take Joel Rosario, and he looked like to be the best out there in California. So I let Tyler and Michael go actually at the same time and took Rosario and end up with 7 titles in a row. I think we won in California by $38 million in purses. And from there, I took him after 2.5 years. I talked him into going back east to New York. To Saratoga because Johnny Velasquez had broken his arm or leg or something, was going to be out for the summer. So I told Joel, we're never going to be leaving riding the nation, riding in California. All the money is in New York and they run more days. You'd have to be back there to be leading riding the nation. So let's go there and for show the country who's the best. Mm-hmm. And he agreed with me and went along with it. And we went back there into Belmont the last few weeks. You know, the end of the meet, things were really slow, waiting for Saratoga to start. And I think by the time the Saratoga was going to start, he was already, you know, just down in the dumps. And Ron Anderson, the other agent, been in his ear after him for about 6 months. And I think he caught him at the right time because Saratoga started and we were third leading rider the first 2 weeks. And he'd come to me and said he was going to change agents, which was a super, super shock to me. We were doing unbelievable for the first time being there. But he had got convinced and manipulated, you know. And them jocks, when they're down, the first thing they want to do is change an agent. You know, they never look inward. They're always looking outward. So that didn't work out. And from there, I went back to California. And I took a year and a half off and started another company, actually.
Really?
Yeah. A friend of mine introduced a product to me and wanted me to be a pitch man and shoot an infomercial and be a pitch man for this product. And he showed me what it did. It looked like a miracle. I told him, I don't want to be the pitch man. I want to buy a piece of this. Mm-hmm. And we talked to the guys that bought us the product and showed it to us. And we bought it from them and kept them in for a piece. And we launched a company. It's a company called SaveZorb. And it's a industrial hazmat products company for oil, chemical, paint spills. It's an environmentally friendly product. It's just a miracle of a product, I think. It's a natural plant material that absorbs and biodegrades oil. So we've had that company about 3 years, and actually last year we did about $800,000 in sales, and it's looking to double this year, hopefully. Things are going really well. And in that time, I also bought a UPS franchise in New Orleans. My ex-wife runs it. My kids work there, and it's the number one store in Louisiana, the number one UPS store in Louisiana in sales. So I've just had an entrepreneurial desire and to do something outside of horse racing, also to sustain me later on when I can't do it or don't want to do it. So after getting them up in the ground and running, I got called back in to ride to work for Gary Stevens a couple of years ago at Del Mar, and I went, and we had a great summer. And at the end of 2 months, he was not happy. I didn't pay enough attention to him or hold his hand enough, I guess. And he wanted to go back to his old agent. So we separated. And again, I went back working in my companies. And then again, the next summer, a rider came. They looked me up to take a kid called Santiago Gonzalez. So I jumped back in and went to Del Mar with him and battled the leading rider until the last 4 or 5 days. And Pratt beat us out, I think, by 6 or 7 winners. And I had a fantastic summer. And when that summer was over, though, I just, you know, it didn't seem a perfect fit for me, and I wasn't really motivated and happy to stay doing it. So, again, stepped away, and I've been just kind of working in on my other businesses, and I've got another passion and vision I've had, and I'm writing a book right now. So I started the book a couple, 3 months ago, and I'm actually writing a book of stories about my journey.
Really? When is this going to be released?
Yeah. I'm hoping my target date was July, opening day of Del Mar. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping by July, could be earlier. I have a target of May, June, or July to get that done. And then, again, this agent thing come up now. You know, I've been brokering and selling horses over the years on a small scale, and I've been doing that for the last 6 or 8 months and taking care of clients, you know. And so between that, my other businesses, it's just a lot of different outside interests. Now I am back with Robbie, back in the game, you know, and excited to be doing it.
My jaw is dropping right now, Ronnie. Everything you've accomplished, I'm glad you're writing a book, because we sure can't talk enough. We can't talk about all of it with this hour. We only have an hour here on the show. We could spend probably 5 hours talking about your story, Ronnie. I mean, the list of names you've mentioned, the jocks you've represented, Mark Guidry, Pivau, Joe Talamo, Tyler Bays, Joel Rosario, Gary Stevens. I had him on the show last week. I mean, you have accomplished so much. You're part of some wonderful business that is such great things for the environment. UPS, you're writing a book. I guess you had practice back in the day when you were going to high school and riding at night and you didn't get much sleep. I would think you don't get much sleep these days either with everything you keep busy with.
No, I say the truth. Honestly, what I learned is the one thing you got to have is the rest and sleep, nourishment and rest. If you're not resting 6, 7, 8 hours, you cannot be at your peak performance, riding, working, whatever it is. So I do sleep. I mean, in California, I might be in bed at 8:30 at night. I'm up at 5:30, but I mean, 8:30, I want to be in bed. I love my sleep. So I do. I work hard. I work a lot, but I do sleep well. And I try to eat real well. I work out, exercise. So I'm really health conscious, you know, into that movement and spiritual with that positive thinking and spirituality. And I think that feeds me into success in life. I'm just blessed. I've been so blessed. That's why I wanted to write the book, because I had 150 people ask me, when are you going to write a book? I want to see your book. I want a copy. I'm like, what are they talking about? So after all these years of hearing this, I finally decided maybe I should think about that. Maybe my stories are interesting or funny, because I've got some funny stories, some crazy things, some amazing experiences. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to listen to them. So that's what inspired me to do it, was people asking me to and telling me to. The CEO of Churchill Downs about 8 years ago, one morning when he said it, or 7 years ago, he said it to me. I'll never forget. And he said, Ebanks, you got to write a book. When are you going to write a book? And I thought, well, you know what? That's it. Now I'm going to do it. This guy, you know, that impressed me to think that he would say that. And I decided I was going to do it. I started jotting down, you know, stories and things and experiences that I had. And then I actually took a course about 2 months ago in Vegas, a weekend, called Write Your Book, Write Your Bestseller by Choice Weekend. So it's a lady that does this professionally. She's written a number one New York Times bestseller. And a friend of mine was helping put it on and told me about it. I'm like, that sounds amazing. I want to go just experience it. So I went and experienced it. So I have a team with me that is now helping me, supporting me with the writing of the book and, you know, getting it together. and I'm going to give it a, I'm going to give it a, my best shot.
Oh my God, I cannot wait. I'm going to, okay, I'm going to buy a copy, Ronnie, and then you're going to have to sign it for me because this is,
yeah,
this is awesome. I can't
it's
wait.
It's exciting. I'm fun. If not enough for my kids, you know, and my friends, and it's something I always, I've been, you know, had a desire to do. So I thought, why not? Why not? And like the lady said, every one of us has a book. You know, it's
just
who wants to take the time and put it down because we all have a story. All our stories are different. And mine, another unique part you might not even know is I was born in the Cayman Islands in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And all my family's from there. And we left. My father was from Louisiana. My stepfather came there working. My mom married her and brought us back to the U.S. So I'm a Caribbean-born kid and raised in the South Louisiana. And then this jockey thing and then this business thing and the other side of my journey. You know, it's amazing traveling the world with all these wonderful, amazing, wealthy friends that took me around in private jets and, you know, amazing parties and carnival in Rio. And just, it's just been unbelievable. I have a saying and a joke, and I say it to my friends, and they laugh. And I said, if I died and got reincarnated, do you know who I'd love to come back as? Me again.
Understandable, Ronnie. I tell you, I love doing this show because I love to hear the stories and just incredible stories I've heard over, I've been doing this a couple years. I got to say, you have one of the best stories I've definitely ever heard, and I cannot wait to read your book. Everyone listening, go out and buy a copy of Ronnie's book when it comes out in July. This is going to be an incredible read. I mean, just what we've heard so far in this short time. It blows me away, Ronnie. I tell you,
I'm flirting with the title. I think it's going to be called "Big Passion, Big Life."
Oh, I love it.
Book of stories, you know.
Love it, love it. I'm writing this down right now. Awesome, and you're making a comeback, as you mentioned. You know, you got out of the game for a little bit, and then did some great things, and now you're back. When you first talked to Robbie and realized that you were going to be returning to the racetrack, was that a relief? Did you miss being in the game?
Not really. No, because I was so busy. I have, you know, kids. I have a business in New Orleans. My kids are in New Orleans. I have a granddaughter that I just adore. So I was there spending a lot of time with her at my business and supporting my family. We had some issues, family issues to help out with. And between that, taking that course and writing this book, my businesses, the one in California, the one in New Orleans, my time was just really, like, you know, filled up. So I was just in a great place and happy and wasn't looking or thinking to do it just yet, you know. So it come about, you know, I stumbled into it. In the universe, you know, there's no mistakes. There's no accident. And I guess the universe just kind of directed me and put me back there because I called my friend to give him a jockey and end up with his jockey because he had decided to, you know, work for another rider, Corey Landry. So, you know, and then again, I called Robbie after talking to him, thinking I'm going to get Robbie to help me figure out how to cool Lin down and work this back out because they've been together so long. They're both my good friends, you know, and I think I'm a decent negotiator, and I thought I could coach him into working this out. And when I spoke to Robbie, he was upset now. His feelings were hurt. So when you got two emotions on both sides that's, you know, broken and hurt, it's a tough thing to bring together then. And Robbie is like, you know, we've had a couple instances already. This is the third one. This is enough. I'm going to find another agent. It's just meant to be. So I said, what are you going to do, man, if you got a week? He's like, I don't have a clue. Yeah. And he said, like, what about you? I'm like, well, I didn't even think, but, you know, I mean, maybe I'll think about this. I guess you're such a good rider. I love him. You know, he's a great rider. He's a friend of mine. He's got business. You know, so I said, for sure I can get there and do Keeneland. I'm going to be in Florida for a week, but I can come right there. And I'm always going to be at the Derby every year anyway, so I'll definitely work through Derby. Let's just see how it goes. Let me see. I mean, you try it, you know. He said, great, sounds awesome. That's good enough. We'll go from there. So that's how it started out, and I'm like, I couldn't believe it. In that conversation, I'm going to work, you know, unexpecting to, really. But I'm excited. I'm so excited because he's riding so well. He's had such a great winter. He's got a bunch of really good horses. He just got nominated to the Hall of Fame. Mm. I was so proud and happy for him with that. It's just so amazing. Time, maybe it was just meant to be, you know? So I know we're going to have a fun time. Keeneland is already getting cranked up and looking great for us. So it's super exciting. And Robbie is just, like I said, excited as can be, too.
Tell you, Ronnie, everything happens for a reason. I'm a firm believer in that. And I can't believe we only have a couple minutes left here. But real quick, by the way, I am going to tell you, you got to tell Robbie he's got to come on the show here sometime. But
oh, yeah.
What do you guys have coming up for the Derby?
Well, he rides the horse in the Bluegrass, and I wish I could think of his name. I'm terrible with names, and I just got back in, so I can't keep all in my head. But Dale Roman's a very nice horse, and Robbie's really excited about him. He runs Saturday in the Bluegrass, and Dale Roman's the trainer, and he just won the Gotham, and we look for him to have a really big race in the Bluegrass. If he does, that would be our Derby mount, hopefully. And if not, and they don't run, and we don't have a mount, then I'm going to be shopping. There'll be a couple horses, a few horses still open that I'm already looking at. So that's yet to be determined who we're riding to the Derby, but we hope to have one with a real good chance.
An exciting time of year, Ronnie. That's J-Boy Zecco, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, and I tell you, especially I host a show with Anthony Stabile, a handicapping show throughout the week. The Derby trail this year has been crazy. You see horses getting hurt and Mastery and Ella Reeb and McCracken's coming back.
Yeah.
I mean, it has to be exciting for you guys because it's like wide open.
Wide open, you know. And you see it every year, and then there got to be more defections, you know, more stepping up. Don't forget, they have a horse come out, the Lexington, and won the Derby. So we got, you know, four or five preps left, and some shuffling to do, and some horses are going to be stepping up their next race. So it's way wide open, in my opinion, too.
Exciting times, Ronnie, exciting times. What's real quick, what's next for you guys after the Derby?
Well, I mean, what I see right now is we ride, Keeneland, me and Robbie, first time, or not the first time, actually, I worked for him when he was 16 years old. I forgot that in the story. He came to Chicago at 16. I took him with Shane. Shane asked me to take him, or one of the boys from Louisiana, and I took him for about a month and a half, and then I had to leave, and I told him, kid, you're going to be a star. Don't leave. Stay in Chicago. Don't go back home. And he was young and intimidated, and he went back home and didn't listen to me. But sure enough, 3 years later, when he came back and showed up in the big time, he says, I didn't listen to you, but I knew I'd be back. And I had the confidence in him from the beginning, you know. But that being said, so we're going to ride out Keeneland, hopefully have a great mount in the Derby in the Oaks, and business will go from there. You know, Robbie will stay Churchill all the way to the end of July. So if things are working out, me and him are both happy, that's probably the logical thing, you know. Only time will tell. And from there, we kind of let business dictate, you know, what happens and where you go.
Exciting times, Ronnie. Wishing you all of the best, you and Robbie, going forward. And folks, check out Ronnie's book when it comes out in July. Ronnie, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Folks, if you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out our website at horseracingradio.net. and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. While you're there,